right. I'm here with Jethro Grant for another episode of Better Know a Burner. Jethro is one of the Colorado contingent burners. He actually drove to Love Burn this time. How many miles was that?
2,100 miles.
2,100 miles.
Each way.
Each way, towing an art car that he built. Mm-hmm. So that's dedication worthy of an episode of Better Know a Burner. And Jethro, I've always known as a fascinating fellow. Engineering background and...
chemistry.
Chemistry.
And telecommunications.
One of the creators that make the burns as exciting and interesting and technologically fascinating as they are. So, welcome.
Oh, thanks.
We're here sitting around a fire, drinking a couple of rum drinks.
Ah, yes. The burn. A propane fire, no less.
Propane fire, no less.
The world is going towards propane. You know, back in the day, my first burn back in 2000, it was fire and iron. I mean, they'd had these incredible structures. Even in the early days, remember that that bullet they had? It's a amusement park ride. It goes around in circles, and it also spins at the same time. It's huge.
Yeah,
it's like 30 feet on two arms.
They used to call it the chuck bucket, or people always threw up in him. And...
Back then, they actually covered one with corrugated steel.
Wow.
Right? And burned wood-burning fires inside of
and
this at
it.
The burn, and spun it. And the main goal of it seemed to be release sparks and embers in the wind of the burn. So that's what it was like. They didn't think too much about mooping all of that ash and stuff, you know. And you might have seen it in your early days of the burn, but that...
I did not go to my first burn until 2011. I'm a newbie. Halcyon. I talked with Halcyon back in 1987 or 8. He was one of the first people on the internet. Mm-hmm. And we met in a chat room after he was interviewed by Mondo 2000 magazine or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And he said, dude, you got to go to the burn. And I always kind of remembered that. And then when Heather mentioned the burn, I said, hey, that's that thing in the desert. She said, yeah, you got to go. And that's when I finally went. So it was nice to actually finally meet him at the Love Burn after all those years. What, 25 years later after him telling me I should go, I actually went. So.
I was wondering if I saw you that first
year. When did you first go to the, what was your first burn?
My first burn was in 2000. And actually, my experience wasn't really all that good. I mean, my roommate in Colorado was really into it. But he was like one of these big acid heads, acid dealers. So we went out, and in those days, it seemed like you went out on Thursday. You know, you did a college kid, you pulled them, you know, all-nighter, and you kind of drove out to this thing called Burning Man. You were going to go for 4 days. And so we drove out in a van, and he had a bunch of his friends there, and they had built one of the scaffolding towers, like the Skybar. And so I'm, you know, river rafter, and I'm used to sleeping in tough environments. And, hell, I can take a sleeping bag and throw it on the desert floor and just wrap myself in a tarp. And I figured we'd be able to do that out there. And we got out there up on this thing, and the wind was just blowing all night, and the tarp's making all this racket, plus you're tripping on acid, because he was feeding you tabs like, yeah, here, take this, everybody else says we'll all be at the same level, you know. And I remember the biggest thing was, this is back in the day when I was still really into live music, you know. I had played in a band and stuff, and I really wanted to bring, hearing all the EDM. You know, we just called everything techno at the time.
Right.
I'm like, God, is a techno fucking everywhere? We need to have live music here. And it had been my goal for 15 years to bring live music to the burn, hence the Screaming Jays coming to Sharky's.
Wow.
So that was the driver.
So let's back up. Let's not jump right into the burn. me about, obviously, like I say, you brought an art car that you built yourself. And
mm-hmm.
And you've been, you know, going for many years and fascinated. And I think I saw you first time I saw you, I always referred to you as, who's that, the peacock? Because you always reminded me, like, of a male peacock. You were just
strut my tail feathers.
You were wearing a robe that was all lit up with LEDs. I mean, you stood out amongst.
Oh yeah, the ghillie
suit.
The
grubby hippie masses. I mean, you were the peacock among men, and definitely looked like a fun character to meet and know. And you were
always fascinated with light. You know, my background is spectroscopy. Was the study of light. So chemistry took me into analytical chemistry, and I had various jobs as being a spectroscopist, using FTIR mostly, but understanding how FTIR works within waveguides. So crystals, a fiber optic is a waveguide, and so I like the way the light performs and diffracts and the way humans perceive it. Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite things to do here by the pool is to just put a little wave in it so that we can see the patterns that it make on the bottom and the flame.
Oh, yeah.
The flame here shining over and flickering is fascinating.
So if you take a laser and use the angle of incidence where it reflects like a mirror, you can put a wave on that and shine a wave pattern on a wall.
That would be cool.
You know?
Yes. So how did you get interested in all of that as a kid? I mean, where'd you grow up? Tell us about. Let's go all the way back.
Oh, well, I'm a Florida native.
How did little Jethro become Jethro?
Hollywood, born in Hollywood, and parents moved around a lot, so I had a lot of Southern influence, mostly food wise. But mm-hmm. I did a lot of worked on shrimp boat and did a lot of crabbing, you know, playing around in the beach, mm-hmm. making the beach sustain. So you kind of learn as a child. You know, the gift of life, you know, here's the shells or here's, you know, the bird carcass that's rotting, but the fish are feeding on it or the bugs, and then the birds are feeding on the bugs and fish, and you know, so you learn about being in the cycle of everything, and that made me really respect the principles when I first saw them, and, you know.
Yeah, that's awesome. That was something... I almost, you know, early. I looked at some of the early films of the burn, and it really looked. It was kind of rednecky. I mean, it was a bunch of guys in trucks and shooting. They were shooting things, and
well, because they could.
Yeah.
You know, and it's one of those things. If you're allowed to do it, people tend to push the limits.
Right, right.
You want to go right to that line. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes even exceed that line a little bit, like the art car we saw this year that sunk itself into the sand.
Right, right.
You know.
I always credited Halcyon for a lot of that as being one of the early people on the internet. He was, in my mind, one of the first people that promoted the principles, and it kind of went out to a lot of the artsy web designers. And
right.
So they were unique in that they combined a technology background with art. So there was a lot of art and technology.
Being from the Bay Area,
yeah,
you brought in technocrats and people that wanted to express themselves. I mean, look at Steve Jobs. He took a lot of acid. Yeah. He was a hippie. And he had a true respect for the individual and how they interact with technology on a one-on-one basis, not necessarily mm-hmm. a corporate, you know, entity.
Yeah.
You
and know? I think that heavy influence, it definitely influenced the music, I think, that we hear at most burns, and then the nature of the art, a lot of the art has a technological flair to it.
I think economics does come into a play partially with that because, I mean, once you've created your EDM content, essentially, so the first copy cost you, you know, $10,000 to make and time and labor and stuff, and then the second copy cost you cents mm-hmm. or nothing to reproduce it and play it, and then it's gravy. As opposed to a musician who may spend years learning an instrument, but when he goes out to the burn, he's got to play, and it's his time, and it's his commitment, and therefore most musicians want to be paid.
Right. Right, that's right, no one gets paid.
Yeah, and so since there's not supposed to be any economy.
That's how we all listen to techno, it's inexpensive. You
know, so, you know, back in the 80s, of course, we called it a mixtape.
Yeah.
Right, you know, and hey man, I got my mixtape, and I remember those parties of battling. No, play my mixtape, you know.
So you you made a living as a chemist,
analytical chemist, doing spectroscopists. Particularly, I did a lot of forensics work, analyzing fibers and using we had a device called an infrared microscope, and analyzed very tiny particles of which most people know as dirt. Well, that dirt actually contains things. It came from somewhere, you know.
I've seen microscopic views of just a handful of sand off the beach and tiny shells that are so small you just can't believe how tiny they are.
Right.
Little pieces of coral, amazing, just in every handful of sand.
Yeah, I got to meet some amazing people in industry that are brilliant scientists. So, for instance, I think his name's Paul Scholes. He was arguably one of the leaders of the band Boston, and he also worked as like VP of R&D at Raytheon, or one of the big defense contractors. And so I was installing a infrared system in the lab at Raytheon, and I got a chance to meet him briefly.
Wow.
And I went into his office, right, and behind him on the wall he had this micrograph. Right, which is it's a micro photograph of something small as opposed to a photomicrograph, which is something different, right? And it had all these big canyons. And I looked at it and I said, what is that? Because of me being a river runner, right? I'm like, wow, what is that canyon? He goes, oh, that's a photomicrograph of Eric Clapton playing Layla, the middle break. And he had actually put a piece of a record inside an electron microscope and had this picture of it that he posted on his wall.
Yeah.
You know.
I just remember that he was famous because he was one of the first musicians to actually build his own studio to bypass the need for a record company.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so they actually had their own basement studio that he built for, what, $100,000, whereas they normally cost $1 million, and it was one of the early ones. And
yeah. Well, and then they tried to build it out where he had sort of infinite time. To more or less infinite time to go in there and do takes one after the other until they got it right.
Right.
And that's why if you listen to the record, the first album, it's really perfection. Mm-hmm. You know, these guys are just on it.
Yeah, I was a fan. It definitely sounded different. I got into punk and new wave after that.
But, yeah.
but when that came out, it was so different than anything else that was out at the time. All the big hair bands and had kind of a, I don't know, I mean, a lot of people liked that music, but I was actually strangely not a fan of 70s music.
Yeah, it was kind of like intelligent rock. You know, there was that genre out there, the other smart bands like, that album Breakfast in America, done by Supertramp.
Mm-hmm.
They were a bunch of very smart guys. The guys in Rush were pretty smart,
yeah.
You know, and creating even the guys in Queen. You know, a couple of them were like PhDs in various scientific mm-hmm. disciplines. And so this I think in many ways connects with the Berner Expressionist, where you have brilliant people wanting to expand their knowledge base in the traditional sense into the artistic realm.
Yeah.
Say, you know, hey, I don't want it just to be for a scientific company, but let's push the envelope of art.
My first year, Lisa and I's first year, we stayed in a camp with Elon Musk's family.
Oh, yeah, right. Uh-huh.
And I met him getting ice. You know, had I known that he was just a PayPal guy at the time, had I known he was going to become who he was, I would have gotten on my knees and begged him for a job or something.
Oh, I would have just said, can you put me on the ticket list as a gift? You know, him and Richard Branson is another inspirational guy. It was one of my dreams to actually go into orbit before I die. It'd be nice to exceed the speed of sound.
200, right now, what is it, $250,000?
52 miles. Oh, the much, money?
Yeah, were they charging or something like that?
They're doing suborbital, they're trying to book suborbital flights on Virgin Galactic, I think he calls it now.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, smart. I, as a kid growing up, I always wanted to have a company by, you know, I love the Jetsons, so Spacely Sprockets or Cogswell Cogs.
And, people call me that when they get drunk. They
so go, I registered. I registered Paul's Prototypes. .com and WilliamsWidgets.com in case I ever form my Jetsons company.
Mm-hmm.
What
like Spacely Sprockets?
Exactly. Exactly. So as a chemist, I mean, how many years did you do that? And you don't do that now? Are you retired?
Well, I did, undergrad chemistry, and then I went into analytical chemistry because I'm more like the mechanics rather than wet chemistry or sitting behind a chalkboard and coming up with, you know, you can work for weeks on a particular theory or formula, and you kind of get a satisfaction math, but as an applied chemist, you're able to see results, or an experimental chemist rather than a theoretical one. You can see the tangible results, or you can do experiments, to confirm what you believe in theory, and I like making that connection with the real world. A lot of chemistry is alchemy. We don't really know why it happens. It just happens this way. And as you start doing the education, you go from things like ionic forces in water to van der Waals forces to quantum mechanics, and the rules change for all of them. They're incompatible from one layer to another. Okay, forget everything you've learned, and now we got something new. You know, and all the stuff that happens in the real world doesn't happen in the theoretical world. So there's definitely that anomaly. I don't want to, you know, I'll let the really smart people deal with that, and I'll do the instrumentation because I like the idea of atomic absorption, mass spec, NMR, which is MRI. Mm-hmm. They took nuclear out of the phrase to stop freaking people out.
Bad for marketing.
To make you get into the tube.
Right. At least right? When I did it, we both nuclear, did like a full
what?
Body.
It's a bigger microwave, really. Yeah. I'm going to cook your brain. But we'll have a nice picture of it before you go.
We talked about, earlier we were talking about our mutual love for Carl Sagan and the movie Contact.
Oh, yeah.
You mentioned doing acid in the desert. Your knowledge of the primary components of nature, did that definitely, did that influence how you experience your acid trip? I mean, it definitely
totally.
Did mine.
there's nothing like, you mentioned before, there's nothing like looking at a handful of sand, or looking around the desert and wondering how it formed scientifically.
Right.
Like the Black Rock Desert is one of the most geologically active regions in the United States, second only to the Yellowstone caldera, right? And they have hot springs all over it. I mean, there's crystalline formations that you can find. It's just a fantastic area, not to mention that it's part of the Great Basin, and the Great Basin network has no outlet for river. So all the water actually sinks into the ground. So everything that's there has been there forever. It wasn't washed in or washed out by geological forces.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah, I didn't know that. So tell me about your recent trip here. I mean, across the country.
To Love Burn. I was chased out of Colorado by a massive snowstorm. It dumped 17 inches in Boulder, and I had to get ahead of it. And I was about 6 to 8 hours ahead of it and running through. So these massive fog banks set in because of it's the jet stream that's powering all of this. And it deposits stuff in Colorado, but the jet stream's extremely fast. I mean, you've got 80-100 mile an hour winds that are running up in the jet stream, sometimes higher depending on the storm. So I got hit by massive fog banks in Kansas as I'm driving all the way through Kansas. So it was really driving through visibility from here to 30 feet, away, and you're doing 80 miles an hour on a highway and just trusting the lines.
Towing
on the
an
highway.
Art car.
Towing an art car, yeah.
A massive art car, by the way. Pretty big, actually.
Yeah, ultimately, it compresses into a small space. So I was a whitewater river guide, mm-hmm. and I had Grand Canyon boats, a 14-foot cataract and a 16-foot cataract that all use a frame assembly. And each one of these boats can hold, 25 and 3,000 pounds, respectively, 2,500. And so I'm looking at it one day when our art car's canceled at Sharky's Bar, my bar on the playa. And I'm looking around my yard. I'm like, God, it sucks we're not going to have an art car here. And I look around. I've got two quads in the backyard, a bunch of, scaffolding tubes for making my raft frames, and a couple of rafts. And I said, well, I could build an art car. And this concept's a little bit different because I use a trailer to pull essentially a stand-up space. So now you can put, you know, 8 to 10 people almost per side standing up. So I run 16 to 20 people probably around capacity on the art car. And it stands and it bounces. People just love things that bounce.
It was fun. We had a bunch of people in the back and rolling around. We did bounced an old lady.
Oh, yeah.
That was shocking.
She caught a little bit of the air.
She went flying.
You know, well, she didn't want to get off the art car, you know. She'd rather stay on and think she can hang on, and I don't think anticipated how bouncy she might get.
I was happy that she was okay.
Yeah, me too. She seemed a little bit shook up, so we dropped her by medical just in case.
Oh, good, good.
Have them look at her. But
so you have any favorite burn memories, or what's your craziest burn experience? Not necessarily this one, but you know, you've seen it change over the years. You've seen it go from your first year was probably what, just a few thousand people.
Well, it was still fairly populated. It was like, I don't know, I think we had 25, maybe 22, low 20s. You know, it had grown pretty popular by 2000, but that's where you could buy tickets at the gate. Mm-hmm. You know, people were not turned away as part of the radical inclusion philosophy. If you could make it out to the middle of Nevada, they figured, you know, you were entitled to a ticket. And they had plenty of space, so they didn't have the trash fence or the perimeter, the Pentagon perimeter. So people would actually get in their cars and do a road trip out to some canyon way down the desert, and where a tributary fed into the lake, and there'd be rocks and structures and stuff around it. But at the same time, you'd be, you know, looking for a place to take a leak behind a rock, and so it turns out you wandered into the target range where they were, you know, shooting guns. And so I'd have to say not having the guns is kind of cool, in my opinion. Yeah. You know, unless it's going to be a very controlled environment. But my friend still brings a flamethrower to Burning Man every year. They're apparently legal. I've seen that change. The live music that I mentioned before, our camp was very popular with bringing in back a live element as an alternative. And we were strategically positioned right behind the bank of Port-a-Johns, which is a block long. And how many would you say is there? 100 Port-a-Johns, you know, a lot. So people would hear the bluegrass playing in the can and then come out and say, I want to go to that bar.
Yeah. A few minutes, and so, wow, okay, that sounds like a fun place to be.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know that, you were instrumental in getting the Jays out. The first interview that I did was with Jake. Screaming Jays, and we had a good conversation.
Did he say how he went to the barn?
He mentioned Corrine and Heather, that he had met Corrine out at one of the places, I guess, where you were. Maybe that was one of the Colorado places. So that's how they got passed along to us, and we kind of adopted them here in Florida and brought them down and then laid claim to them to a certain extent. Now we think of them as ours, whereas you probably you knew them before we did.
I think I met Heather back in 2008. Mm-hmm. And she had attended Apogea, which is a Colorado regional burn. And then I don't think she had been to a Burning Man event yet, but we had set up plans to go in one of the following years and met her out there, and it was a good time. I remember that it was Illustrious Industrious, I think, was the first camp. That might have been her first burn. It was a camp, and her and the girls came out, her and Kay and Kate, a cat. Mm-hmm. And we had a great time. We had a little Airstream. We actually had a diesel-fueled distillery on site and illustrious, industrious, where we could distill, show people how to distill fryer later oil into diesel fuel. And we ran our generators and all the trucks and stuff on diesel, biodiesel. And that was pretty innovative at the time.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
We had the G-Spot. It was the 7 o'clock in G. And it's as you know, that's a big keyhole spot, a big circle. So we had one of those bases.
You had all our dancers. We when they all left, there was nothing going on here in our town. So we had Heather's kind of the hub. And
right.
And then Cat and Kay are our dance crew.
The staple.
And once they were yanked out of this town, everything got really boring for a few weeks while they were gone.
For every Labor Day, there was no party.
The we don't have to worry about gaps because I can edit out any pause.
I didn't know if it was.
I'll pause. So you mentioned earlier that you know, what attracted you about Burning Man was the ten principles and everything else that was going there. How have the 10 principles affected your philosophy of life and maybe changed or influenced you or influenced your outlook on the world and, really caused you to be attracted to the burning community and be a big part of it over these years?
Well, a couple different reasons. I guess the first thing is I'm being a river raft and fundamentally leave no trace, you know. The concept of being able to go out to an environment and care about it, you know, not treat it, not give too many, create too many crying Indians.
Right.
So to speak, you know, is to maybe leave the place better than you left it and improved, but not permanent, organically improved, that cooperates with nature. The other aspects is the decommodification. I'm tired of going to an event and being sold a funnel cake, or something like that, something cheesy. Right. You know, I feel a little guilty about overpaying for it, And then I think a lot of people sort of get, when they feel taken advantage of a little bit, they sort of get like sort of a fuck this place kind of attitude.
Well, you're a capitalist, I'm a capitalist, and yet, we enjoy just appreciate, I don't know. There's something special about, you can see how things could fall apart after a while, but there's something very special about people whose minds are like-minded, who are willing to be, to give rather than just take.
I think that's a type of capitalism that you deal with. There's many different flavors. There's exploiting everything, as much as you can. And that's where you get that, greedy douchebag, hyping up the EpiPen.
We've seen it. Yeah, we've both seen the excesses of capitalism.
So you go to the other nations in the world. I went to Africa, and the South African economy is based on something called cost plus. Here we have a free market system. Charge whatever you can, and if you, based upon supply and demand, that's your price, right? If you don't have very much supply and people are willing to pay, you jack up your prices.
You crave shortages and desperation that you can capitalize on.
To hype up the industry, like last night when I made $100 for storm crabs a pound. in Miami.
The stone crabs appreciate that.
Right, maybe wonder if this red tide thing wasn't just created.
To jack up the price of stone crab.
Either that or you already got red tide that's already on the product. So there's an element of that, but in South Africa they have cost plus, which is here's your cost and we're going to give you 15%, and that's a fair price. So that's where you get outstanding bottles of wine for $3 or $4. That's where you get calamari steaks down there for like $5-6. You know, it's what it costs them to create something plus a little bit else, and it kind of shies away from the incorporation of here I'm relating to food, the incorporation of food. So you have more mom and pop restaurants with creative
such, and not just necessarily pulled out for the maximum margin that you can get on a product. And they don't care whether, I mean, some restaurants
are skimping,
the stuff is frozen or anything, and they give it to you as long as they can make $5 a plate.
Right, skimping in every way in it as much as they can get away with, while still charging you as much as possible.
Yeah,
and
it's the market,
trying to get it on both sides.
Market economy based system to maximize profit. And I think humanity doesn't need that set as an economic example to exploit every resource they have. That maybe there are some resources out there that we should feel blessed to have them. People can make a reasonable living off of. And I think decommodification helps that. The mantra is to bring enough food and supplies for yourself and some to share.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that people, if people are in need, you can reach the immediacy, which is another principle. So a lot of the principles are related in my book.
Mm-hmm.
If you reach the immediacy as, oh, God, I'm thirsty now, I'd love some water, or in our case,
and the joy and the love of just being able to help somebody who needs it, or feed someone who's hungry, or there's a lot of satisfaction there that transcends what you, oh, I could have charged that guy for a cup of water.
Right.
He's so thirsty. you go, oh, I made 100% markup on my water. As a capitalist, that's how you would think.
You're not exploiting your fellow human being.
Right.
Cooperating.
Right.
Sharing that will solve some of the world's great problems. So in Africa Burn, they have an 11th principle, and it's called Each One, Teach One. And that actually comes down from 100,000 years of human evolution on the continent of Africa. So when you met a stranger in the woods, you didn't necessarily take an aggressive stance, like, what have you got, or what kind of deal can I make, which is modern capitalism, right? Back then it was like, maybe this person has a new way to make a fish hook, or set a snare for a small animal, or even a new sexual position. So a wide variety of things can happen. And I think that's another component that drives a lot of Burning Man is sexual desire that's repressed in the American culture, that people feel more expressive out there to say what they feel and admire, and maybe share some ideas on a tapestry that isn't heavily regulated by society's morals mores or religion.
Yeah.
Government. You know, you could go to jail.
I saw a this was kind of strange along those lines. I saw a guy who on the playa, and he just stood out in the middle. And he pulled his pants down, and he started flipping his penis back and forth, flopping from side to side, until he got an erection. And he's just waving it, and he's just flipping it back and forth, back and forth. And and then he got tired, you could see, and no one was paying any attention to him, and nobody cared. And he just got tired, and then he stood there and looked around, and his penis went down. He reached down and he pulled his pants up and then walked away. And I thought, you know, he obviously had some sort of a flasher kink that he was trying to get out.
Right.
And he was probably anywhere in the United States, people would have like, oh my God, they would have freaked out and called the police, and he would have run, and it would have been all exciting for him. And yet there the burn, nobody gave a shit. Nobody cared, and they didn't care, and it became boring to him. He went limp, he pulled his pants up and walked away. And I thought, you know, as weird as that was, it was probably good therapy for him, and maybe he got over his kink a little bit, and, you know.
But what an interesting and fairly... Depending on the observation, Grant, what a fairly harmless kink. Unless
he didn't attack anybody or anything like that.
People was chasing him, unless that was his goal.
And it just wasn't shocking because there was so much other spectacle going on around us that was more interesting than some freak guy, you know, flipping his wiener around. So, pretty strange.
Like a tassel. Could he do the helicopter?
He was doing a pretty good job
was
of it,
going
yeah.
Clockwise or counterclockwise?
He was just flapping back and forth, just flapping back and forth. This,
linear,
this,
only in two dimensions.
The smacking, yeah, just back and forth. He was, it was a really weird thing. But yeah, that's an aspect of it. Just the ability to run around. I mean, run around your underwear in the desert or naked if you want to.
I do like that aspect, but I have another part of the Colorado Boulder culture that's into the nudist party thing. We go for vacations on Lake Powell on a houseboat, and we'll just be naked the whole trip.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I haven't seen as much of that at Burning Man, but although it is around, we've just completed our second year on the Naked Pub Crawl, and so we are the second stop at 8 o'clock in B.
I haven't been out for that. I've been, I know you guys do the bike ride, basically.
Oh, Critical Tits.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's mostly women. The Naked Pub Crawl, I mean, now is mostly men. It's really the Naked Sausage Fest.
I think, yeah, I mean, it's funny because I think a lot of that is overblown. You'll read the descriptions of the different camps, and a lot of them are, kinked out and stuff. That orgasm camp at the name Loveburn,
right.
Sounds like, oh my God, you'll tell friends that you're going to the Loveburn, and oh, is it like a big orgy or whatever? And I think I saw like maybe, five naked people the whole time I was there, and the orgasm camp was basically, it wasn't like people were giving orgasms in the camp. It was if you had an orgasm while you were at Loveburn, you put a little X mark, and they were trying to reach a certain number of orgasms for the week.
Found a condom on my arm.
It was very tame by any general standards. Yeah, I know, but compare that to like Cancun or any college party. I mean, that would be, any of that would be far more sexualized than the Burns.
Right across the street from Bad Astronauts, which is ironically who we camped next to at Apogea, and we're friends with all these guys, and they send people to our place to drink the alcohol.
Yeah.
But next to Comfort and Joy, they had the promiscuous tent. Sorry, consensual tent that you could go in there and actually, get a space, and then we'll give you condoms at the door, and you can have sex. And then beyond that, they had the Bill Cosby camp of the non-consensual tent.
Oh, that's crazy.
And their cocktails there were really strong.
I don't think, that's the whole thing. I think that everyone's usually so dirty and sweaty out in the desert that there's not as much of that going on as you would imagine.
Mm.
It's not exactly conducive to full range sexual activity. What?
Did your bull just fart?
I don't know what's going on over there. I think just some water dripped off a tree or something along that.
Fish?
I don't know.
I'm sorry, John.
But no, I think that's an aspect. This year was. I find most burners are very respectful, and even at the Big Burn. Everyone was very respectful, no leechers.
Past couple of years, it's been a shell shock with the whole, they're talking about making an 11th principle or adding a principle that's consent in this state because there's a lot of concern, with the Me Too movement and all of that,
mm-hmm.
about what consent is, and particularly at a burn event where a lot of people are taking a lot of drugs, and they're targeting events that have questionable consent, and it's been shown across in research that society, American culture, is actually having less sex now. They're spending more time on Facebook and having remote interactions, and I think there's a lot of targeting for murder type
I think that's probably a good thing. A good educational forum. The teaching of the rest of the principles has definitely affected a lot of people's lives and changed how they are and who they are and how they behave and how they think about the world. These are all healthy things that that I think the burn brings to people.
Time we had that discussion. It's time that people really got real with everybody's opinion. What about the people that like to be sexually expressive? There should be a place for that.
Yeah, I've seen. I've definitely seen some of that at the Big Burn. There was we did walk through a camp, but even district. That was probably one of those popular dance areas, and run by, I believe, mostly a gay male camp.
Yeah, and a lot of Colorado people.
It was surprisingly tame. It wasn't anything that you wouldn't see anywhere else and anywhere.
I think the burns have definitely toned it down over the years. Now that they're feeling it's more public and people are more conscious about issues.
More respectful, I think. More appreciative of the other aspects of the 10 principles that naturally lead to consent and respect and, treating people well as...
Getting away from society's norms, I think many people have different educational experiences of what they, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, of what society was like then and needing to change rapidly. And what's going to help that is community. It takes community to raise a child, they say, right? A village. And it takes a community to continue nurturing the children in all of us.
That's a good point. Yeah. The children in all of us. Yeah. We all start at zero and hopefully mature as adults as we go along. But we're always work in progress.
I think the burn brings back the simplest of pleasures that people want to perceive, the self-expression. Radical inclusion is a big one, that feeling that no matter how kind of weird or wild your idea might be, other people may feel the same way, and let's connect you guys together and maybe take it to the next level.
I think so. I agree. That's a great thing. Just about everybody's able to find people who appreciate the diversity and the individuality, and then we see the result of it collectively, and it winds up being a pretty entertaining thing.
It was Larry's vision. So Larry used to come by our camp back in the day, and they would talk about philosophy and things that he saw at the burn, and he really feeling that it was his job to create the canvas and let the artist express, and rather than saying I want specific types of art, is let's free range it. What if you gave everybody all the paint, right, and just let them do what they want? And that's kind of what they're trying to do with the burn, and we're seeing it reflected through a common culture. We're seeing a lot of products that are being more individual oriented rather than corporate tailored, one would hope. Respect for organic foods, respect for different cultures, nationalities, religious beliefs in many cases, we're getting empathy. Mm-hmm. And we're getting empathy through socialization, direct socialization with people that go to the barn.
Yeah. Even from the simple things all the way to Elon Musk's Solar City.
Well, and I think it'll go to the regional burns. And I think that's really helpful because you're expressing the regional cultures and people can...
You mean the Burning Man, just the Burning Man as a whole is spread beyond the Big Burn to the regionals, and now the regionals are growing and kind of
hundreds.
Taking on...
I mean, there's hundreds, not just around the United States, but there's international burns in many countries, like 30 or 40 different countries, of which I've been to, Africa Burn, but they have them in Australia and New Zealand and Japan and many countries out there, which allow us to explore the burner concepts through a cultural lens, like someplace like Japan that has a thousands of years of culture, you're going to see how they perceive the 10 principles and how they've evolved. But the connection extends international boundaries. You know, you may, 100 years from now, I mean, the burner belief system may be a common culture that threads through humanity. It has so many benevolent principles out there and the ideas of inclusion. It'll be interesting if they further develop it, because there's a couple of principles that are almost contradictory to others. The idea of community and immediacy, for example. I mean, do I do something to help my community, or do I do something to help myself? Those will be conscious choices that are not really described in a one-liner that each of the principles are.
Well, so, I know that so many people are involved with Burning Man, or, you know, they're cultural creatives. They're innovators, and they're creating media and, you know, movies and a variety of other technologies that are spreading out. And then in these local groups, we have our local tribe, and we're all interacting with each other locally on a far more frequent basis than just the events themselves. So it does, you know, transcend, and we bring in other people, and young and old, and it's interesting to see it grow. And
it's also an interesting element is that it has a throttling aspect on the over-commercialization of something that becomes popular because of the decommodification principle.
Keeps that out of it.
That a lot of people may, you know, people at the burn don't necessarily do everything for money or for extravagant amounts of money. You know, this year's funding was $1.5 million for artwork, which many people consider that to be kind of low, at least on the artist side. But other people say, hey, look, we're spreading the word without using money. It's not like U.S. foreign policy where we go in and, you know, bribe whoever in order to get them to see things our way temporarily. Yeah.
Money is usually used to purchase human labor, and the human labor there is many multiples of that initial $1 million.
Well, the idea of being able to have a volunteer based community that's doing it for the sense of intrinsic values, that I'm helping the community, I'm helping humanity, I'm helping my friends. But it also, the idea of the smaller camps doesn't mean you're doing it at a local level. It's not like you're contributing to, the United Way or something. You know, I give them $200 every Christmas kind of thing. You're able to see results. And I think that's what a lot of people want to see out of their contributions. They're willing to spend thousands of hours and hundreds of dollars, if not more, on something where there's a tangible result.
I agree. Yeah, I definitely see that. I remember in this year I did not participate as much as I normally do or would have liked to.
I know.
Because there's a lot of joy. Yeah, I didn't help you do your art car. I apologize
I'm
for that.
Totally kidding.
But there's just a feeling that you get when you look out across all of it and you know that you helped build it.
Yeah.
There's a sense of ownership that you would wouldn't get, that is probably one of the most satisfying aspects of just being there, going, you know, I and the rest of my tribe made this.
If you look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right after you get the basics that Burning Man provides, which is, your sustenance of shelter, food, water, things like that. Mm-hmm. The next level you go is friends and love, essentially incorporated together, which you have in your camp or within the community. The next level of Maslow's is ego. Okay, you need to be recognized for something that you do as being good. Okay, it drives all of us. And then the final level of as we all know, is self-actualization. That's where you determine your own destiny. And that's integrated with the immediacy principle. Hey, I can go to this camp, or I can go to that camp. I can work. I can hang out. It gives you choices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely not a... It would be different than... You can go places and do things, but those are generally hedonistic pleasures that are short-lived and don't give you that added bonus of satisfaction.
Takeaway. Yeah.
Takeaway, yeah. That you that you have value, not that you went and saw something that had value and that you were just a witness.
Or even if it's as small as just thanking others for their contribution. Mm-hmm. I had so many people that didn't even ride on the art car come up to me and thank me for bringing it and coming to Colorado, and you're one of the people that helps make this work. And this is not just your average burner. We're talking the organized. The head of the DMV mm-hmm. came over to me, and we had great conversations about safety principles and how my art car was going to work. You know, that I wanted to do flash mob stuff, and I intentionally, for now, don't have a music system on there because I want to, any camp I pull up to, I want to absorb in there.
I noticed that. We were driving around, but we were experiencing their camps that we were driving past,
right,
and not overpowering them with blasting your own music.
Yeah, bringing our own tunes, right, and say, hey, I'm going to make my own space, but I'm more going to share in yours.
In your art car, we were standing and looking out.
Yep.
We weren't obsessed with the experience of the art car itself. It was all visual and open, and the thrill of it was riding through all the other camps and seeing what other people were doing. A lot more connection out,
yep,
than in. Interesting. We were going to, I was going to try to interview Brian Wiener later.
Sure.
On one of these, and we were your funny kind of experience with him. I don't know whether you want to get into that, but that was kind of funny.
I see it as a really kind of it's a memorable event.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I was concerned about it because, you know, he's obviously some of a great respect and responsibility, and
yes,
and I. But I, being a New Yorker, I get how quick he wanted to be to make a decision, like, hey, we need to get this out of here right now. We need to make some shit happen, you know. And he's one of the people that drives,
yeah,
the events and makes it not into an anarchy fest. And I'm often not at the receiving end.
I just loved it. I love hearing about it and hearing that it happened because it, I don't know, it's kind of fascinating to me how things work out. It's all volunteers. We're all doing things that we may have never done before. Everyone only sees things from their own perspective, and yet here we are. We're trying to see things from others' perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And I know Brian had taken on just a gargantuanly
DPW's
complicated, unbelievably complicated job.
DPW.
And,
you know,
and then the little things that go wrong, sometimes they're fascinating, because I always saw you as a very, you know, you're a very innovative person. You build things, you make things, and I almost, like, you know, was going to say, oh, here's our local guy who does that.
Right.
Here's,
yeah,
our Brian, yeah, Wade runs the Maker Square, set that thing up. He's basically you know, legend down here for,
sure,
for doing those kind of things. And it was,
as soon
it was
as
funny,
I heard
because
his name,
two strong personalities kind of get together. And yet, you know, your first encounter was where he, like, oh, my God, this guy's got his damn car in a space that I need. And you were like, I just hauled this freaking art car all the way from Colorado, built it.
And I've moved
it
four times.
And you bring it here, and now this guy's telling me to move this thing the fuck out of the way.
Yeah,
and
right,
the clash was just was
it
delightful.
It was my plan versus your plan,
yeah,
you know, as
yeah,
the bigger, he had the bigger wiener.
He had to eat it. Yes, yes, the bigger wiener in that situation. Brian ruled. But I'm glad that you guys, yeah, you kind of worked it out.
And, oh, we did. We shook hands,
yeah,
and stuff.
And didn't
wrestle
or anything.
I get him.
Yeah.
you know.
But you guys will have a laugh about that someday, I'm sure.
Oh, one day. I'm sure we will. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. It should be good.
Well,
it's...
My favorite people to talk to at Burning Man are people that are not reciting the past. You know, I did this, I did that. You know, you kind of get people that have a story. And sometimes it's a 15-second or 30-second story. Sometimes it's a 3-minute story. Sometimes people go on and on about stuff that another individual can't relate to. But I think Burning Man provides such a tapestry of new ideas that individuals encounter each other and they talk about the future, about what can be. They create the vision. They look forward, not look back. And I think that's one of the things that's going to keep the burn going throughout the years. It's what's caught on with the regionals. It's what... and will continue to grow, you know, that among the other things that we discussed.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And so those are the people that I gravitate to.
Yeah. One of my favorite memories was walking out into the playa for sunset. Now, we walked out naked to see sunset, and there was kind of a little bit of a sandstorm at the time. And I didn't see that I was walking up on somebody, and there was a guy sitting there. And I thought, oh, I'll just leave him alone. I started to walk away. He goes, come over, sit down. You know, he'd been meditating out there. And he turned out to he was an Indian guy who had gone to Harvard, had a PhD in economics. And at the time, I was doing that little company called iKarma, iKarma.com. We were trying to, you know, change how reputation is used as to generate value for businesses, and we had a great conversation about changing the world. He was working for a nonprofit and doing some stuff, and then a little art car came out, and people jumped out, and they said, you want to spin? And we didn't know what they were talking about, and they pulled out whirling dervish costumes, and we got dressed as whirling dervishes, and as the sun went down, we spun around in circles and drank wine that they brought. And watch the sun go down as we were spinning, and it was just fabulous. But that's a kind of, kind of forward thinking with a respect for history, and it just tied it all together.
What I got out of that, and is a common theme I definitely agree with, is respect the stranger. Okay? Don't fear the stranger. I think a lot of people go through lives of like, oh, well, another person. They look down, they look away. And I think in a burn environment, you look towards. And your hunger, you're eager for new information, ideas, perspectives. But looking, as I was saying before, looking forward, not looking past.
I agree.
Yeah, we never know where that new idea will be spawned. You know, there's something that will, you know, unite humanity in ways that are beyond political or religious boundaries, and help focus on common problems. You know, we could look all around us and say, you know, the trash heap in the Pacific, the fossil fuels, renewable energy, famine, disease. Once people start looking as a commonality, as brotherhood, you know, then this may be a way that, like I was saying, takes us through the boundaries and unites individuals, especially as the internet and social networking takes hold, that we are able to take the hands of people and other parts of the world.
Or even our search for meaning as we transition away from a superstitious society.
Right.
Yeah. You touched on that earlier. The personal satisfaction that you got from doing the art car, and those kind of just the joy of serving and then having it enjoyed and witnessing it and feeling valued and experiencing their joy and using something that you provided.
No, and that brings up another principle, participation. So, I mean, it's strongly encouraged that people engage. You know, you're not going out to the desert to cocoon in your camper. You know, you're participating. I mean, much of the artwork that's out there is designed where the person needs to do something. I mean, in some cases, it'd be as simple as pulling a rope with the holographic skeletons or you need to speak your voice into a LED lighted hall to get a reaction. Big motivator. My camp at Illumitorium, I had interactive lasers in my laser chandelier that shone down on a phosphorescent table. Now, the table would function autonomously on its own and draw spirograph images and tracing the ultraviolet lines, but it was strongly encouraged for someone to come up and grab the individual element and write their name or just scribble around, and an immense amount of pleasure, like a child building a sandcastle or writing his name in the sand and then watching the waves come over it. Some of that stuff's been happening for hundreds of thousands of years to humanity, and I can't believe that it's not somehow genetically encoded that we appreciate things like the ocean, waterfalls, fire, staring at the moon. I mean, many of the things that humanity's fascinated about, but they really don't know why.
That's probably a good way for us to wrap up as we sit here, having a conversation around a fire, the way mankind has done since the beginning of our time on Earth as
fire.
Human beings, staring at the flame and enjoying each other's company and stories.
Right.
Well, thank you, Jethro.
Thank you, Paul.
What a great episode of Better Know a Burner, and nice calm night. We should have a good recording. I'll get this posted in a few days here and let everyone else enjoy knowing a little more about Jethro.
Wow. Thank you very much.
Have a good evening.